more on induction. These are particular problems that can come up in induction and a couple of applications. One problem that we have understanding probabilities is we've got numbers, but it's not exactly clear what those numbers mean. And to tell you the truth, they mean different things in different cases. There are three basic ways to think about probabilities. What we've really been doing is the classical theory of probability. And this applies to any time when you've got a bunch of possible outcomes, and those possible outcomes are equally likely. So when you figure probabilities on the classical theory, you divide the favorable outcomes by the number of total possible outcomes. And this works for dice throws, coin tosses, card draws, anytime you've got a bunch of events and those events are equally likely. So you have on a coin toss, two events, and heads, tails, and they're both equally likely. So, for example, you've got four kings out of 52 cards. Probability of getting a king equals 4 over 52, 1 over 13, as you well know by this point. But the classical theory only works when all these cases are equally probable. In other cases, we think about frequencies, mainly because we don't know the probability of all the possible outcomes. So when we figure probabilities on this account, we take the favorable observed outcomes divided by the total observed outcomes. And this is how we do probabilities for insurance, for example. The insurance company wants to know what's the likelihood of a man who's a smoker, 20 pounds overweight, living to be 80 years old. Because they want to know how much they need to charge this guy for a life insurance premium, so on. And so what they'll do is look at a sample of people who meet those conditions, find out how many of them live to be 80 years old, and divide that by the total in the sample, and that'll get them a percentage, and they'll use that percentage as a probability. And here's some instances where we use this sort of frequency version of probability theory. What's the likelihood of a teenager being in an accident? What's the likelihood of having a tornado when weather conditions are like they are now? We use it for medical diagnosis. If you get a positive on this test, what's the likelihood you have the disease? Another way to think about probabilities is in terms of degrees of belief. In this case, we don't have any idea what the relevant frequencies are. It may be the case that there is only this one single event, and we don't have any sample to compare it to. And even in those cases, we still have some basic ideas of how likely things are. So, given the testimony, how likely is it that the defendant is guilty? Well, we're not going to have access to lots of other cases where we had trials and had testimony like this, and in those cases we figured out what's the percentage of trials where we had testimony like this and the defendant was guilty compared to the total. That doesn't make any sense. But the jury is still thinking in terms of how likely is it that the defendant committed this crime given the testimony. Or we make predictions about sporting events. How likely is it that Team A will beat Team B? If we're using the frequency theory, we'd have to have access to a lot of past cases where A and B played, but it may be the first time that they play each other, so we really don't know, but we still have beliefs about likelihood. So we think about this in terms of something that's really subjective. How confident am I that this is true? We may be able to, in some cases, we'll assign a high degree of confidence so that I would be very, very surprised if it turns out to be false. Then I'm willing to bet a lot of money on this. A lot of cases where I'm fairly confident that it's false, so my subjective probability is closer to zero than it is to one. A lot of cases I don't know. Half and half either way, I assign this sort of subjective degree of belief probability 0.5. Now, once you assign these three different theories, all determine how you assign probabilities to those simple events. Once you have the probabilities for the simple events, the same basic probability rules apply in all cases. All three theories use the same conjunction rule, same disjunction rule, so on. Okay, what do these numbers mean? Well, if the probability that I'll roll a 2 equals 1 over 6, that means in the long run, I'm going to average 1 2 out of every 6 rolls of a die. That should be R-O-L-L-S, not R-O-L-E-S. Some things spell checkers just won't catch. Now, a lot of probabilities have really low numbers. For instance, the probability of drawing two kings with replacement versus without replacement equals 1 over 169 versus 3 over 676. Now, the difference here is 15 over 10,000. That's not a big difference. Okay, sometimes these really small differences matter. They matter in science, for instance. If I'm sending a spaceship to Mars, I'm really concerned about really small differences in my trajectory because it's going to make a difference whether the spaceship gets to the planet or completely misses the planet. These small differences can make a big difference in, let's say, somebody who makes their living playing professional poker, and so on. But they don't really make a big difference often in basic human daily life. Well, how do we understand these differences in size? What's the probability of a U.S. citizen being killed by terrorists? Well, it's less than 1 in a million. What's the probability of dying in a car wreck? About 1 in 5,000. Now, that's a huge difference. But it's really difficult for me to comprehend the difference here. What's the real difference between 1 in 5,000 and 1 in a million? Well, I can understand that the difference in probability if I can understand, if I can get my mind somehow wrapped around the difference in the size of those numbers. So we've got really small numbers here, 1 over 5,000, 1 over a million. Maybe I can understand the small numbers if I can understand the difference between 5,000 and a million. So if I change it to a big number, understand the relative difference, I can translate that to the relative difference between the fractions. But we're not really all that great about understanding the big numbers either. Well, it helps if we can translate these terms into things that we can visualize. Well, I just looked on the internet, and 5,000 is roughly the population of Hera, Oklahoma. That's a small town kind of between Shawnee and Oklahoma City. Really small town. A million is a little less, not much less, but a little less than the population of Dallas, the city of Dallas, not all the suburbs. So what does that mean? Well, that means the difference between 1 in 5,000 and 1 in a million is the difference between randomly picking one particular person out of Hera, Oklahoma, randomly getting one particular person in Dallas. So imagine you have a friend lives in Hera. What's the likelihood you go to Hera, you're going to bump into that person? Well, you might think it's not just driving through town. It's not overly likely, but again, you wouldn't be very surprised if he did. You have one friend in Dallas. What's the likelihood of driving through Dallas and running into your friend? You'd be extremely surprised, right, if you were to do that. So if you can think about it in those terms, that will help you understand the difference now between what's the likelihood of dying in a car wreck and what's the likelihood of being killed in a terrorist attack. Extremely unlikely in the terrorist attack. It's still really unlikely to die in a car wreck, but it, unfortunately, it happens a lot more, many more times than people who die in terrorist attacks. Okay, here's some analogies. It takes 11.5 days for a million seconds to elapse. How long do a billion seconds take? 32 years. Well, that helps us understand the difference between 1 in a million and 1 in a billion. Huge difference. Okay. Now, most of the time, we don't need to think about the numbers to understand the probabilities and the probabilistic reasoning. So, for example, we can think about it just in terms of, is it bigger or is it smaller? What's the likelihood of a conjunction versus a disjunction? Okay. So, we know, let's think about one simple event. Call it A. And assign it some probability whatsoever. Now think about the conjunction A and B. Is that going to be a higher value, or is it going to be a lower value than the probability of A? Well, we know the probability of a conjunction A and B is going to be smaller than the probability of any one of those events, either of those events. So provided that they're not a zero or one, that tends to mess it up. But remember, that we'd be multiplying, since it's a conjunction, we're multiplying fractions. You multiply fractions, the product goes down. Okay, but if it's a disjunction, A or B, it's going to go up, because you add fractions, the result, the sum's going to be greater than either of the things that we add. So we can think about it in terms of, if we're adding conditions that have to be met, it's going to be a conjunction, and the probability is going to go down. If we're thinking in terms of several conditions, and you only have to meet one or the other, then the probability is going to go up. Okay, here's an application that you need to understand, is expected value. When you decide to, when you're trying to decide what should I do, in a lot of cases, you're going to make this decision on what's going to be the payoff. Okay, so when we do that, what we're doing is calculating the expected value of a particular action. Expected values are the probabilities that are relevant to decision making. When it comes to actions, when it comes to decisions, the probabilities are relevant. Okay, so whether or not something's likely to occur or unlikely to occur is relevant to what you're going to decide to do. But the costs and the benefits of the action are relevant too. Now, expected value is a function of the probability and the payoff. Okay, let's imagine that we've got a basketball player. She hits 40% of her shots from less than the three-point range, and she hits 30% of her shots from the three-point range. So if she's making a two-point shot, attempting a two-point shot, she's going to hit 40% of those. Okay, if it's a three-point shot, she's going to hit 30% of her attempts. So the probability of hitting a three-pointer is lower than the probability of hitting a two-pointer. But the payoff's higher, because she gets 3 points rather than two. So how do we weigh these two considerations? What are we going to tell her? She asks us for advice. Should I try more three-point shots? Should I try more two-point shots? Well, you should try what's going to get you the most points in the long run. So, over the long run, what does she get? On average, she gets 0.8 points per two-point shot, and she gets 0.9 points per three-point shot. And this, in the long run, is going to add up. You know, for every 10 tries, she's getting an extra point when it comes to the three-point shots. Now, how do we figure that? Well, we use a formula called the expected value formula. The expected value is the sum of the probability of each possible outcomes multiplied by its payoff. So if we only have two outcomes, as in the case of the basketball shot, you either make it or you don't, success and failure. The expected value is the probability of success times the payoff plus the probability of failure times the cost. Now the cost is going to be negative, so what we get is subtracting a value there in the end. Okay, here's an example. In a game, you roll a die. If you get a six, you win $6. Okay, if you get anything else, you have to pay $1. Okay, the expected value is positive 1/6. How do we figure that? Well, what's the probability of success? 1/6 times the payoff, $6. Is 1, right? 1/6 times 6, minus the probability of failure, which is 5/6, times the cost, which is minus 1. So what we have is 1 minus 5 sixths equals 1 sixth. So in this sort of game, you should expect to get 1 sixth of a dollar every turn. Well, you're not going to get 1 sixth of a dollar every turn, but in the long run, you pay, it's going to come out a little bit ahead, right? After 6 tries, you should expect to have get a dollar. So it's a pretty good game in your case. Bad game for the other side. Okay, we can do this in terms of more than two alternatives. You just add up all the possible outcomes. So let's say you have three possible outcomes, A, B, and C. We have probability of A times what you get if A comes about, plus the probability of B times what you get if B comes about, so on. A bet is fair to both sides if each side has an expected value of zero. You don't expect to gain, you don't expect to lose. Okay, gambler's fallacy. You commit the gambler's fallacy when you treat independent events as though they're not really independent. Flips of a coin, we know are independent. Okay, what if you get heads on the first one, that doesn't influence whether or not you're likely to get heads on the second one. Now, if we get 10 heads with a fair coin, it's pretty natural to think that the next toss is more likely to be a tail. Why is that? Well, people talk about it has to occur to even things out, or because there's this thing called the law of averages. The point is that the coin doesn't remember what it got on the last toss, so none of that's affecting what it will get on the next toss. They're independent events. Well, we've got four, let's say we have a family, they have four boys. Surely the next child's going to be a girl, they're thinking. Like to have a girl, let's try one more time. Well, are these dependent or independent? Well, that's really a scientific issue. It's an empirical question. Some sense, I guess the actual frequencies are relevant. But if they are independent, then the probability of getting a girl, given that you already had four boys, is still 0.5. Now, with these cases, it doesn't really matter whether we have precise probability values or not. We don't really have to know what the probabilities are. But if we have good reason to think that two events are independent, we shouldn't act or we shouldn't believe as though one of them can really influence the other. Okay, the conjunction fallacy. The conjunction fallacy is when you judge the probability of a conjunction as being more probable than its conjuncts. So here's a common question in reasoning studies. Say Linda's 31 years old, she's single, she's outspoken, she's very bright. She majored in philosophy when she was in college. When she was in college, she was deeply concerned with issues of discrimination, social justice. She participated in anti-nuclear demonstrations, so on. Now the question is, which is more likely? Is it more likely that Linda's a bank teller, or is it more likely that Linda's a bank teller who's active in the feminist movement? Another example, which alternative seems to be more likely to occur within the next 10 years, an all-out nuclear war between U.S. and Russia, or an all-out nuclear war between U.S. and Russia in which neither country intends to use nuclear weapons, but they're drawn into a conflict by things going on in the Middle East? Well, in both cases, there's a tendency to say that it's much more likely that Linda is a feminist bank teller than just a bank teller. Much more likely that there's a nuclear war that comes out of issues going on, events occurring in the Middle East, then there is to be a nuclear war. But both of those answers would be wrong. And here are two ways to see what goes wrong. Okay, we know that when two events are independent, the probability of A and B is equal to the probability of A times the probability of B. So if the probability of A is 0.9, the probability of B is 0.9, both pretty high, the probability of A and B both being true is only 0.81, right? You multiply them together. Now, that works when they're independent. In this case, they're probably not independent. Who knows? In the case of Linda, it's hard to imagine her the characteristics that lead her to be a feminist activist are also the characteristics that lead her to be a bank teller, so maybe they are independent. But even when A and B are not independent, you're still multiplying fractions together, so the probability is still going to go down. So that's the first way to see what the problem is. The second way is just to remember that the more specific you make something out to be, the less probable it will be. Okay. What's the likelihood of your we just saw a few slides back, what's the likelihood of your dying in a car wreck? To be morbid here, 1 in 5,000, let's say. What's the likelihood of your dying in a car wreck that was caused by a drunken driver? Well, it's got to be less than 1 in 5,000. What's the probability that you die in a car wreck caused by a drunk driver who is driving a Ford pickup, right? So the more specific I make it, the more and more the probability decreases. Okay, the conjunction fallacy plays a role in mistaken reasoning about probability of success and failure. Okay, so let's think about system failure for a second. For a spacecraft to work, you have to have all these different subsystems all work. Everything has to go right for it to work. All right, the computer has to be working. Probably several computers have to work. Radios have to work. The engines have to work. You can't have any failures in the O-rings. The heat tiles on the outside, as we know with the space shuttles, have to be working. So this is all a big conjunction, right? Subsystem 1 has to work, subsystem 2 has to work, and 3 and 4 and so on. Okay, and as we add all of these conjuncts, as we add more things to the system that have to go right, the probability of them all working is going to go down. For example, let's say this system has 5 different subsystems, and the probability that each one works is 0.9. So it's got a pretty high probability that it will work. Well, what's the probability that they're all going to work at once? That's 0.9 times 0.9 times 0.9 times 0.9 times 0.9, which turns out to be a little less than 0.6. So each time we add a subsystem, the probability of the whole thing working goes down. And it doesn't take much for it to go down below 0.5. Okay, you can make the same point in terms of disjunctions. Either the first one can fail, or the second can fail, or the third can fail, and the probability of a disjunction is going to be larger than the probability of the disjuncts individually. Okay, and this also happens with respect to things that occur all the time, right, over and over and over again. So you have an instance where this thing has a likelihood of failure in one instance. It's a really small likelihood of failure. So you do this one time, you can expect that everything will work. Well, if it's got a 99% probability of failure, so you do this thing, you've got 99% probability of an accident, you do it once, you shouldn't expect to have an accident. But you do it 100 times, maybe it's going to get pretty likely that you're going to have an accident. So an example are contraceptive devices. They have a failure rate, and people often make these mistakes about failure rates in contraception. For instance, let's say that particular contraceptive device only has a failure rate of 0.01, so it will fail 1 out of 100 times. Well, a couple who uses this contraceptive device through the course of their marriage, they'll think, well, we've only got a 1 in 100 chance of becoming pregnant using this thing. Well, that's each time. So if you've got a 1 in 100 chance of a pregnancy, use it 100 times, what should you expect? Okay, regression to the mean. A school gives a test to all these kids, standardized test at the beginning of the school year, again at the end of the school year. Okay, then the average both times is 100. But they see this sort of curious thing that children who get below average the first time tend to improve, and children who get above average tend to do a little worse. So what's going on? Well, a couple of explanations. It could be the case that you've got the good students who are pulling the poor students up. Maybe the poor students are pulling the better students down. Or it could be the case, and this is probably the likely explanation, is that this is just regression to the mean. More extreme scores or performances tend to be followed by those that are closer to the average. Okay, and regression to the mean can occur in any instance, any kind of situation that involves chance. Test retest situation. Okay, you go in, you take the GRE to go to graduate school. You do pretty badly, a lot poorer than your average. Okay, well, more than likely, you go in, take it again. You're going to do a little bit better. Okay. There's something called the Sports Illustrated jinx that people talk about, and it goes something like this. Once you get your picture on the cover of Sports Illustrated, you're doomed to have a bad performance year. So it originally came up in I think it was 1957. The University of Oklahoma had won a huge number of football games in a row, and Sports Illustrated put them on the cover, and the caption read, "Why OU is unbeatable," and the very next game, Notre Dame beat them, ruined their winning streak. So that started what was known as the Sports Illustrated jinx. Another instance is the sophomore slump. You have a really good freshman year, turns out sophomore year, not so good. Well, what's going on? Think about the magazine cover. Why did they get their picture on the magazine cover? Well, it's because they're doing a lot better than average. If they're doing a lot better than average here, it shouldn't be any surprise that they end up doing less than average later, right? That's what you would expect. You expect, when it involves chance, you expect that a certain series of things over the mean going to be followed by series under the mean. Well, think about some instances where reasoning mistakes are likely to occur with respect to regression of the mean. You've got a crisis. Crisis may be increasing crime. Or in your business, you've got a drop in sales. Well, you've got to take some measures to handle the crisis, you think. So what should you do? Well, if you've got a crime increase, you may want to increase the number of police, so on. So let's say you do that. You spend a lot of money, you increase the number of people on the police force, and what happens? Well, it could be the case that you notice that the crime rate decreased. Well, the question is, why did that occur? Why did the crime rate decrease? Did it decrease because you put the extra police, or was it just a case of regression to the mean? Here's an example. There was a study on Israeli fighter pilots. So when Israeli fighter pilots were praised after a good performance, they usually did worse. When they were chewed out after a bad performance, they usually did better. So the question is the negative reinforcement better? Is chewing somebody out for bad performances better than praising them for good performances? Is the stick better than the carrot, and so on? Or is it just a case of regression to the mean? It can also lead us to make some mistakes in prediction. Let's say that somebody has a great game the first time you see them play. What are you likely to predict about their next performance? Given your small sample, your very small sample here, which may be a very biased sample, it's natural to predict a future performance that's a lot like the one that you just saw. But there's also likely to be some regression. If it turns out that that person's performance was a lot better than their average, then their next performance is very likely to be something worse than the average, or closer to the average, let's say. Or job interview. Somebody just pulls off an outstanding job interview. You expect their performance in the job to be very, very good. A person who doesn't do such a great job on the interview, you expect their performance on the job to be not so hot. But it may be the case that this person's performance on their interview was much better than average, so their long-term performance is going to be average, right? And this other person's performance on the interview was much worse than their average performance, so the second person in the long run would perform maybe even better than the first person who had the better interview. So this gives us all kinds of reasons to make inaccurate predictions. You know, we already talked about the crime increase problem. So we instituted this policy. The policy was we're going to put more cops on the streets, and the crime rate went down. Well, it could be that the drop in the crime rate was just an instance of regression to the mean. So our policy may have had little or no effect, and we're spending all this money on a policy that we really don't know is having any causal effect. It could just be a coincidence. And these coincidences, they give us this illusion of being in control of the situation when it's really just chance. It may not be chance, but the point is we just really don't know. Well, what about coincidences? Some things happen that just seem so unusual that we think there's absolutely no way this could just be chance. For example, a man survives a disease, and the disease is fatal to a degree of 99.8. So 99.8% of people who have this disease die from it. So this man survives. Well, it's a miracle. Surely something here is going on. But it turns out that for a disease that has a fatality rate of 99.8%, two out of every 1,000 going to survive, and this man could just be one of the two. Now, if we describe an event in enough detail, it's going to seem really unlikely, like we talked about with the car wreck. So you flip a coin 10 times. The probability of any particular sequences of outcomes is 1 over 2 to the 10th. But each one of those sequences is equally likely, and one of them will occur. So let's say when we get a string of tosses that's 10 heads in a row, if I predicted that I will get 10 heads in a row, and I get 10 heads in a row, you'd think that either something tricky is going on or it's a miracle. But actually getting 10 heads in a row is just as likely as getting head, tails, tails, head, 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 tails, tails, so on. Any specific instance of 10 tosses. But it's much more unlikely that I'm going to make this easy prediction that I will get HTT, HHT, so on. Before I tee off playing golf, the probability of the ball landing on any particular spot is really close to zero, but it's going to land someplace or another. The problem is, I don't usually specify. Given my golf game, it's impossible to specify, but I don't usually specify where it's going to go. But if I could, right, then it would make it seem really, really improbable. But if I don't specify it beforehand, it seems as no surprise, it just lands where it does. Okay, a little bit about risk, since we're not going to talk much about that chapter. a lot of risks in life. You can handle those risks better if you're able to assess them with some good reasoning about the probabilities involved. So to assess risks, you need to be able to appreciate these large differences in probabilities, the terrorist attack or the car wreck, and to take into account regression to the mean. Well, that's it on this particular chapter on applications and pitfalls in probability reasoning.